On air, across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
This is Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Cambridge Film Show, broadcasting here on Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. The tinsel is fully packed away, festivities are over, and 2022 is finally here. Let's hope with a sense of optimism. And here is our first show of the year, and it's a bumper one, with plenty of recommendations for treats to watch at the Cambridge cinemas, but also a couple on streaming if that's where you're currently feeling more comfortable, or indeed you're isolating and need some entertainment. I'm Emma Marchant, and with me today to talk all things movie are Henry Jordan, Lorcan O'Neill, Yossi Osman, Simon West, and Ashley Whittaker. A full six films to pack in this week. I know we spoil you, from Maggie Gyllenhaal's atmospheric adaptation of Elena Ferrante's The Lost Daughter, to P.T. Anderson's love letter to the San Fernando Valley, Licorice Pizza, and the Cambridge Film Festival's closing film, The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne. We'll also be giving our lowdown on the biggest and webbiest film of 2021, Spider-Man No Way Home, and checking out Adam McKay's latest star-crammed satirical comedy, Don't Look Up. But to begin with, we are going to take a trip to New York City for Spielberg's long-delayed, well, delayed in the cinema, long-delayed remake of the iconic West Side Story.
Tonight, the world is full of light.
This is my first time in New York City. I want to be happy here. I want to make a life, a home.
Tonight, tonight.
Are you ready?
Tonight is about family.
On from tackling 80s retro and computer games in Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg has remade Jerome Robbins and Robert Wise's 1961 classic West Side Story. Bernstein and Sondheim's musical reimagination of Romeo and Juliet takes the star-crossed lovers to New York, as this time around, Ansel Elgort and newcomer Rachel Zegler are Tony and Maria, members of rival gangs in the melting pot of late 50s immigration. Lorcan, Spielberg has made no bones about his huge respect for the original, and this is an incredibly, I mean, I was blown away by how handsome and how traditional remake this is, what a traditional remake this is. Is there enough freshness here to justify it for a new audience in 2022?
Well, firstly, you speak about handsome. I mean, this film was 2.5 hours of incredibly attractive, sweaty men singing and dancing, so I was absolutely blown away the whole way through. I would say, yes, I was very sceptical, because I didn't understand why someone who has such reverence for a classic film would want to remake it. And it's certainly a tight line to walk, because that's what everyone's going to be thinking throughout the whole thing. It's like, oh, is this scene better than the other? Is the score better, etc.? And I think it certainly revitalizes it for a new audience. Certainly more so than In the Heights, is kind of a lot of similar topics, but In the Heights just was such a flat experience for me, whereas this was like a near 80-year-old man who's bringing so much kineticism to this story that everyone knows. They mix up some of the songs, some of the scenes. They kind of reorchestrate a lot of it. There are some things that work better, some things that don't work as well. I'd say one of the things that don't quite work as well, I think, is the casting of Maria, Rachel Zegler, who is, I think, probably the worst part of it. But then maybe that's a problem with the character of Maria, has always been a bit stale for me anyway.
Well, she's a little bit of, I guess, you know, like Juliet, she's kind of a cipher, really, isn't she? Maria is your kind of glorious virgin that this is all hung upon, this kind of, you know. But I see what you're saying. We're coming into awards season, obviously, with the Golden Globes, although I believe they've been cancelled, really. Cancelled for political reasons. We're coming into awards season. Now, the original, of course, won 10 Oscars. Henry, do you think this is going to see that kind of awards fire in its belly, and should it do?
I think it certainly should. The technical merit on display is incredible, as you'd expect from Steven Spielberg. While the original is a kind of, I know we are just playing a comparison game here, but the original's a really interesting kind of theatrical feeling film. This is Spielberg taking West Side Story and making it feel really cinematic. That first opening shot was a genuine, not digital, crane shot over this abandoned building yard. It's gorgeous and really sets the tone for the splendour that's about to be in front of you. And as Lorcan's been saying, I think most of the performances are incredible. Personally, I loved Mike Feist as Riff. He really lit up the screen for me every single time he appeared. And I have to say, every time he was off screen, the film kind of slightly dulled a little for me. I think if any of the actors are in contention for awards, his name should be front and centre.
I agree, actually, because Russ Tamlin from the original is an incredible actor to follow. But I do also, I would also shout out Ariana DeBose as Anita, who I'd only seen in Schmigadoon. I mean, from what I understand, this cast is mostly, they are stated as stage actors. So you're not going to recognise, as cinema goes, you're not necessarily going to recognise that many of this cast, apart from Ansel Elgort, who probably has the weakest singing voice. But the rest have all been put in there because they are, you know, trained stage actors. Ash, you are always our choreography expert, having had, I believe, stage school training that you may have mentioned once.
Once or twice.
So obviously we've had a revival of musicals in the cinema. How did you feel about the choreography in this?
I loved it. Choreographed by Justin Peck. Impeccable. Very close to the original from what I remember. I have performed in West Side Story before. Also brilliantly shot choreography by Spielberg. So the two of those things marrying together, they were some of the most incredible dance scenes I've seen in recent memory. I rarely like it when musicals come to the cinema, but this was gorgeous dancing, all in the first half though, so I got very bored in the second half.
Is that the fault of? Is that the fault of Spielberg, do you think, or just the fault of the nature of the story?
Maybe because it's Spielberg's fault.
That is not true. This, I think, I have to agree with Lorcan in that he says, you know, this is a guy who is now in his late 70s, and I feel that we do tend to revere these directors in Hollywood, but not necessarily for the right reasons, and they can lose their grip a little bit on making such, like you said, kinetic and vital films. This is such a vital film. It's also, the screenplay is by multi-Tony Award and Pulitzer winning Tony Kushner, who obviously is behind Angels of America and that kind of thing. Did anyone think, has anyone got anything to say about the screenplay?
I think there seems to be a trend at the minute of taking kind of strongly allegorical stories and making them more timely and more contemporary. And I think most of the time that doesn't work. It just makes them feel dated before they even come out. Whereas this film, it's less artifice, like the original Maria, it's very fantastical and there's lots of crossfades, whereas this, Ansel Elgort walks onto a basketball pitch and everything lights up, and then it just turns out that it's just the cleaning guy who's switching on the lights to clean the pitch for the night. But this film does a lot to balance everyone's opinions, everyone's stance. You feel for every character, which is a very, very hard thing to do, especially when you're tackling more kind of heady political themes in remaking a film that's just very black and white for the most part.
Yeah. And Henry, you were talking about obviously the fact that this, you know, Spielberg did film this in real life locations across New York City. It's got that really tangible feeling. He's also, of course, working with his long-term cinematographer, Janusz Kaminski. I thought that the cinematography, I just thought there were shots in that you didn't even think should necessarily work anymore because they're so classic, but somehow they did. Would you agree?
Completely. Sometimes with some of Spielberg's more recent films, like Bridge of Spies, Kaminski's cinematography has been quite overwhelming and overbearing, with the kind of too much light streaming in through the windows, whereas I think it's the perfect fit for this film. It does need to have an artificiality where the kind of real-life stories that Spielberg has been doing recently don't need it, and so I think it kind of works perfectly to end this really gorgeous and intoxicating kind of artifice to the film, which I mean is the greatest compliment.
Brilliant. Well, I think that is apart from Ash, you got a bit bored in the second half. This is 2.5 hours. It flew by for me. I just think this is a really beautiful piece of work and it deserves to be seen in the big screen for sure. And I think that we would all agree with that. It is still showing at the View, the Light and the Picture House. It's a certificate 12A. That is West Side Story. So now we're going to move on to Don't Look Up.
This is not real. This is not real. This is not real. This isn't happening. Kate, tell me this isn't really happening.
I hear there's something you don't like the looks of.
We discovered a very large comet.
Oh, good for you.
It's headed directly towards Earth.
This comet is what we call a planet killer.
At this exact moment, I say we sit tight and assess.
Sit tight and assess?
Sit tight.
And then assess. The sit tight part comes first, and you got to digest it. That's the assessment period.
From his out-and-out comic beginnings with Will Ferrell vehicles, Anchorman and Talladega Nights, Adam McKay has found his niche in star-studded satires in the last few years. After taking on the subprime crisis in The Big Short and Big Oil and the Republican Party in Vice, he is now tackling climate change and post-Trump America in Don't Look Up. Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence don their best normcore as Midwestern astronomers Randall Mindy and Kate DiBiase, who discover a comet which is on a direct trajectory to Earth and will destroy the entire planet in 6 months. Trying to get this somewhat important message to the world, however, via various means, not least using the US President of Orleans, Meryl Streep, is proving somewhat difficult. Ash, after basing Vice and The Big Short, in fact, McKay is taking the leap into complete fiction with Don't Look Up. Does this compare favourably for you?
I wouldn't say it's complete fiction at all. I can sense his tension and annoyance in the story he's trying to tell, which is like, look, guys, this something like this is going to happen within our lifetimes and we need to take this seriously. And you're just infuriated by the very believable reaction of the US government, which ruined my enjoyment of it because I was just so aggravated all the way through just imagining this happening in real time, as we've seen with other huge crises, and unfortunately they lead a lot of the rest of the world in depending on how they react. So yeah, you got your glitzy old cast of anyone who's anyone in it, but I think it was too satirical and silly for such a huge subject. It worked in The Big Short, it didn't work for me here.
Okay, Simon, this, well, we are, once again, it is the classic Cambridge Film Show chat about long films. We just covered West Side Story, 2.5 hours flew by. This again runs at something like 2 hours, 20 minutes. Did you think that this pretty intense running time was necessary to tell this story?
I can't remember really getting bored with it. I actually saw this in the cinema in a couple of weeks before the Netflix release, when Light showed it for a week. And I can't remember getting bored. Occasionally, you're thinking this film could be over by now. And then another act happens, and then another one. And it keeps adding more and more. But all those parts were really enjoyable. I don't think there's really much I would have cut out of it.
Okay, did you find yourself laughing out loud?
I did. I laughed lots. And I was just so uncomfortable watching it. It is so... People keep... One of the complaints I keep hearing about it is that it's so on the nose. But the film was actually written about climate change, and that was the main disaster that it's not parodying, but that's what it's parodying, the response and satirising the response to climate change. Since then, we've also had the pandemic, and we have seen the actions in this film come to pass. It is so prescient, it is so on the nose. It's like, this is what's going to happen, and it is what happened in a lot in with the US government's initial response to the pandemic. So it does, I think that's why some people think it's so on the nose, because it is what happened. However, it was very funny. I thought all the performances were great. Time flew by. It did, this film did actually squeak into my top 10 of the films of last year. So. Oh.
There you go. That's very impressive. Lorcan, in this, obviously the American government is heavily lampooned. Also, we have a performance from Mark Rylance as Peter Isherwell, playing the sort of, you know, the social media mogul, if you like. And it was a bit like his performance, I thought, in Ready Player One, but sort of on steroids and with fake teeth in. But do we think that even this itself, is this a little bit of a tired trope? Is this just laziness to have once again this, you know, it's a combination of, like, it's climate change in our eyes and social media that are killing our world? What did you think?
I think the... Adam McKay used to make cute comedies that were very broad and kind of appealed to the lowest common denominator, but that everyone could kind of enjoy. But now, I guess he started reading books, and now he makes movies that kind of points the finger at them in a very kind of, I don't know, a very kind of lazy way. I was surprised at how much I laughed. It is genuinely quite funny. All the performances are really good. I think I read that DiCaprio was kind of hesitant to sign on, and then I think throughout the movie, they call him the world's sexiest scientist about 5,000 times, so maybe that had something to do with his signing on. I just found it a little obtuse, and I think what a lot of people are saying is that if you want to change people's minds about these kinds of things, probably don't do it in an elitist way that completely alienates the people you really need to get this message to, which is kind of what I took away from it. But if you take it just on its surface-level story, it's very funny and entertaining.
To be honest, I watched it and I was mostly reminded, because I was thinking about apocalyptic films or end of the world films, and you have things like, obviously you can go full misery like The Road, or you can go kind of bittersweet evocative like Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, which I think is a very underrated Keira Knightley, Steve Carell vehicle. But I was mostly reminded by Mars Attacks with this, that ridiculous kind of, and that must have come out, what, 20 years ago? So I'm not sure that this is quite as smart and original as Adam McKay thinks. But that's just my opinion. I would say as well, though, we have talked about all the cast being good, but for me, I think Leonardo DiCaprio did stand out. Also, Tyler Perry as Jack Bremer, who runs the sort of Fox-style morning show, along with an almost unrecognisable Cate Blanchett. I mean, her teeth alone deserve an award in this. And Jonah Hill stood out. Timothée Chalamet pops up yet again. I mean, he seems like has he got a contract to be in every film that comes out recently? Did anyone think that... Is Adam McKay relying too much on a starry cast to carry his films, Ash?
Well, that would be the production, the studio that's relying on that. That's why they've thrown so much money behind a very mediocre film to drag as many people as possible to see it, I guess. And I think lots of people will be tricked into seeing a film because there's someone that everyone likes in here. And especially for those of us who are maybe more into a higher brow cinema, if you see names like Mark Rylance and Timothée Chalamet, you're like, oh, this is going to be good. And then you get in there and it's Step Brothers with a political swing on it.
Well, and also I think, you know, that typical style of, particularly he's done in The Big Short and Vice, this kind of, you know, the editing, the choppy editing, the docu shots in there, if you like that, then I think you're going to like this. But I feel like Simon wishes to disagree with you, Ash.
No, I think it's more a case of all these actors want to be in this film and they want to work with Adam McKay. It's an important story that makes an important point, and all these actors agree with it and want to make sure that they're associated with it. It's not, you know, the studio just trying to get famous people to get to see the film. I think it is an important story. People should go and watch it, and the more stars you've got in there, the better. It's almost like the telethon of satire.
Well, I was... telethon of satire. I was going to say, perhaps in a slightly more cynical way as well, obviously, you know, movie stars, they're just like us. They also had to sit at home for a full year, so I imagine now they might be taking any script that crosses their desk. So I probably feel slightly sorry for the less starry members of Hollywood who aren't getting their scripts anymore because they're just schnaffling them all up. Do we think this would... This is going to be a question later on as well. This is one of our Netflix streamers. It did, like you say, have a short release at the cinema, I guess, to make it eligible for awards and that sort of thing, I'm presuming. Do we think that this would have had legs as a cinema release? Would you say it would be worthwhile as a cinema release?
I think it probably had more legs as a streaming release. I think it would have done okay in the cinemas, but it's such an easy pick for people at home. Be like, oh, that film's just dropped on Netflix that has 15 actors that I know. Whereas to make the trip out, especially during the pandemic, around Christmas time, would have been a slog for a lot of people. So I think it probably made the right choice doing this. And I imagine it's been so popular, allegedly, on Netflix that I think it's probably going to be contended for various Oscars, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's had phenomenal amounts of views. I noticed that as well. But then I agree with you to a certain extent. It feels like it was the perfect Twixmas film, if you like, that you're just watching when you're still kind of just, you know, permanently half drunk and eating chocolates, and this would be an easy watch to watch. But having said that, if you have a Netflix subscription and you're paying $6.99 a month, then I would say you've really got to make your own opinion up on it. That is Don't Look Up. It is a certificate 15 and it is streaming on Netflix. But next up, it is web slinging time.
Ever since I got bit by that spider, I've only had 1 week where my life has felt normal. That was when you found out.
When you botched that spell where you wanted everyone to forget the Peter Parker Spider-Man, we started getting some visitors. From every
Following immediately on from the final events of Spider-Man Far From Home, where Peter Parker has been, in fact, unmasked by Mysterio as Spider-Man, this latest instalment, No Way Home, has Tom Holland's Peter Parker joining forces with Benedict Cumberbatch's, who a bit like Timothée Chalamet, I feel like is in every film ever at the moment, Doctor Strange, to try and use magic so he can go back to his simpler incognito self. But spells can go wrong, and instead of returning to a world of college applications and teenage romances, an entire multiverse is unleashed with characters galore that we may or may not have seen before. Henry, would you say that this is a classic in itself, or would you say it requires knowledge and affection for the many previous Spider-Man movies that have come before this?
Well, so this is a film that is very much using the kind of metaverse kind of thing, multiverse, which we saw in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse a couple of years ago, which is done fantastically. And in that film, it sets up all its characters in their own right, so that when these new characters appear, you understand who they are because of what the film has told you. Whereas No Way Home kind of relies on pre-existing knowledge of these characters, that when Dr. Octopus shows up, you go, oh yes, it's Alfred Molina. I love Alfred Molina. And so I think part of the problem of No Way Home is that it is less satisfying because it relies on that pre-existing knowledge. However, as a way of using that to kind of... if you already have that, which I did going in, it then is incredibly satisfying. I don't know how well this would work if you haven't grown up with the Sam Raimi films or the Andrew Webb films, but I think as a kind of... in this world in which you're always watching all the superhero films anyway and everything has to be completely connected... if you are plugged in, it works really well.
Yoz, you are, I believe, and I might be wrong in saying this, but please correct me if I am, I think you're a relatively recent convert to Marvel, aren't you? Didn't you do the classic pandemic, watch them in order? So you're, you know, so this is all fresh for you and new for you, but I believe you've fallen quite deeply in love with the MCU. How was this for you?
I really enjoyed it. I think, you know, Spider-Man is an icon. We've had so many Spider-Man films that... I think this does justice to Spider-Man as a legend, really. I thought it was really good fun. I thought the cast were brilliant. It does rely on quite a flimsy narrative and what Henry's alluded to around the kind of do you remember this kind of theme throughout. But I think it's strong enough as a film in terms of the action, in terms of the characterization, that it really worked for me. I really enjoyed it, and I didn't remember every character that appears, but I really felt what was at its heart. And I do think that's another thing. I do think this film does have a lot of heart. As you all know in the studio, I did shed a tear many times watching this film, which was quite a surprise to me. But you know, I really felt for some of these characters. I was very emotionally invested, and I think they all, you know, the cast, Tom Holland in particular. I think Tom Holland is a brilliant Peter Parker. He's probably my favourite, although, you know, there are others. But I just think this film really, really worked and was really exciting to watch.
Simon, you fessed up as we came into the studio that even though this has been out 3 weeks, you only saw it, I think, for a second time last night in 3D. Because as far as I know, I think this is available standard, IMAX and 3D.
Yeah.
What did the 3D add some extra to it? What's your take on this? Does it go? Is it straight into your top five of Marvel films?
It doesn't go into my top five Marvel films, and I don't think it even goes into my top 10 of Marvel films. I did enjoy it. It is a good film. However, I did find something lacking about it. One of the problems with traditional Spider-Man films and a lot of superhero films is when they get into the too many bad guys situation, where especially Spider-Man 3, if the Sam Raimi Spider-Man 3, where people can remember that. I just didn't find anything that new or interesting or surprising or that changes too much in this film. I found it a little bit predictable, which some people may think is a little bit unlikely, which meant it was fine. I went along, but I found it just a little bit too formulaic, a little bit too predictable. And while I enjoyed all the performances, I think a lot of it too was too much. Oh, do you remember this character? Do you remember this character? Can you remember this happening? We did it slightly differently.
A bit too much of a greatest hits stream, is this what you're suggesting?
Greatest hits, yeah. I'm sure I'll be watching it again. I'll enjoy it. It will be comfort food. But it didn't have the wow feeling. Even watching in 3D, most of the Marvel films, there are at least one or two moments where, you know, shivers go down my spine. It is just goosebumps. It is, you know, absolutely amazing. I did not get that in this film.
Lorcan, I'm going to come to you because I know that you are... We've talked about this, and obviously Sam Raimi was almost an auteur, really, before he did the original Spider-Man film. So Sam Raimi did the three with Tobey Maguire. And then, as we said, Mark Webb did the two amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield. The director for the three... Tom Holland Spider-Man is a guy called John Watt. That's, I don't mean to be reductive, but he was almost handpicked by Marvel, having done very little else, to do Homecoming. That was a huge hit. Do we think it's anything to do with John Watt's directorial skills, or is really this huge success that later Spider-Mans have had pretty much to be hung on what I think is the incredible charm and hard work of Tom Holland, and probably a delightful chemistry with him and Zendaya, to be fair? But
I think John Watts was chosen to do Homecoming because he made a film called Cop Car, which was like a very cute coming of age kind of almost action film as well. But it took me so long to remember who the director of these movies was, because I've said it before, all the Marvel films just feel like directed by committee and very little input from people who really know what they're doing story-wise. This film builds a lot on the charm of the original directors and previous iterations of Spider-Man. I'm not a big fan of Tom Holland. I think he's kind of a meh. I don't really get a lot out of him. And the bits in this film that I enjoyed were the bits least associated with him. I think the standouts are a few surprise cameos. Willem Dafoe, my God, that man can act. And Zendaya is always absolutely fantastic. But I think this film just, it doesn't have much to say on its own. It relies too much on the achievements of others. But if I know Sam Raimi's coming back for Doctor Strange 2, so hopefully he can kind of nudge Marvel to give him a bit more creative control, because much like Willem Dafoe can act, Sam Raimi can definitely direct.
That was going to be my next question. Are we excited about Doctor Strange, the Madness of the Multiverse?
Yes, I am. I think there's so much. I mean, I actually really... We're going to talk about Benedict Cumberbatch a bit later. I feel like we talk about him every show. But
he's everywhere.
He's everywhere.
Everywhere.
But I really like him as Doctor Strange, and I know there's a lot of excitement coming. And I think Spider-Man just does just enough to open the doors for that level of excitement. And one thing I will say is, if you are a fan of the Spider-Man films and you haven't seen this yet, it is a real treat to go and see this film, because it does honour all the films that we've had over the past 20 years or so. And it's just good fun, and I would really recommend seeing it in a cinema.
I must admit, I took my three boys to go and see it, really enjoyed it. My husband couldn't come at that point, probably. Isolating, of course, that was the case. So he finally got to go and see it last night, and Spider-Man is probably his biggest one out of all the Marvel stuff, and he absolutely loved it. The fact you get maybe more than one Spider-Man for your price of admission, maybe, I wouldn't like to say, is really counting for something. But I am going to take a little bit of umbrage with you, Lorcan, when you say that you feel that Marvel films are directed by committee, because I do feel that both the James Gunn Guardians of the Galaxy and Taika Waititi, no matter how you feel about him, but his Thor Ragnarok, are certainly films that have their director's personalities behind them.
That worked out really well for James Gunn, didn't it?
Well, he's back on GOTG3 now, isn't he? But yeah, you know what I mean. So I think I had no idea, which is why I love doing this show so much. I had no idea it was Sam Raimi coming back for the Madness of the Multiverse, and I am psyched, because this is as much a Doctor Strange film almost really as it is a Spider-Man film. And I think, as Yoz said, you are really going to find something to enjoy in this, and there's a reason why it is the biggest, you know, it's the biggest release of 2021. In fact, in some European countries, they're not even allowing it to be opened in cinemas yet because they're worried about too many people wanting to go and see it. So that's Spider-Man, No Way Home, and that is showing just about everywhere in IMAX, in 3D and in standard, and it's a certificate 12A. You are listening today to the Cambridge Film Show on 105 Radio. We've got just about 25, 26 minutes left, and we've still got three films to cover, so we better move on. So without further ado, let's take a sun-drenched trip to the San Fernando Valley in 1973.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair.
I met the girl I'm gonna marry one day.
But her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go.
Listen, young lady, but her friend is nowhere to be seen.
So how'd you become such a hotshot actor?
She walks through her
I'm a showman. That's what I'm meant to do.
To the seats with the clearest view. Then she's hooked to the silver screen.
Do you know who I am?
Yeah.
Do you know who my girlfriend is?
Barbra Streisand?
Barbra Streisand.
Sand.
Sand, yeah, like sands. Like the ocean, like beaches.
Barbra Streisand?
No, like Streisand.
Sand.
Sorry, that was making me chuckle. Paul Thomas Anderson is back with, I'm going to say, probably his loosest and sweetest and funniest film yet. The auteur behind Boogie Nights, Punch Drunk Love, There Will Be Blood and Inherent Vice, to name but a few, brings newcomers Alana Haim, yes, from the band, and Cooper Hoffman, yes, son of Philip Seymour, to the screen in a kind of May-August couple. Do you like what I did there? Alana and Gary, who are navigating both growing up and falling in love in 1970s California. Simon, this got your first five stars of the year. What did you love about it?
It's almost perfect. I mean, pretty much like any Paul Thomas Anderson film, anything he put his mind to, the evocative feel of being young again, in love, relaxing in California, it's just everything you want to spend a good couple of hours into doing. The performances were absolutely fantastic from two newcomers. I didn't realise Cooper Hoffman was Philip Seymour Hoffman's son until afterwards. But as soon as I heard out, I was like, yes, that's so obvious. I should have known that. He is so talented. Alana Haim is fantastic. Just every single moment of it. It's a story. It's almost not quite a Shaggy Dog story, but it just meanders. You don't know where the story's going to go next. It's a series of vignettes and have one little adventure and then another and another, and you just haven't got a clue what's going to happen, and it's just absolutely riveting.
Riveting. That's not what I was expecting, maybe from such a kind of loose limb film, but I like that. Henry, Paul Thomas Anderson, his last cinematic release, I believe, was Phantom Thread, with Daniel Day-Lewis's last performance, and obviously, but he's been doing quite a lot of work with Haim, the band, directing their videos. Was this feel a little too slight? It's a little bit like a music video. Can you see all of this coming back? How does it fit for you in his canon, which is incredibly varied at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think as far as his kind of feature films, Anderson has really been kind of making a lot of, I guess, Inherent Vice aside, maybe a lot of kind of big serious films. You know, There Will Be Blood and Phantom Thread are these big, like, totemic films. But I think the joy of this, as Simon has been saying, is that it does feel really laid back. It feels really sweet. It's almost kind of entirely without tension. There are kind of moments in which there's tension of, oh, will they deliver the waterbed? You know, is this motorbike stunt going to go okay? But there's this feeling, this wonderful feeling, that none of this matters, that whatever these characters do, they're just going to continue their lives after this. They're going to part ways. They may never see each other again, but that's okay. In fact, not okay, that's wonderful.
Ash, were you invested in the lead character's relationship? Because this, I mean, this opens, you obviously have Alana, who is, she happens to be at Gary's school because she's assisting in the high school photos, I think, but it opens with this marvellous tracking shot. And I'm guessing she's meant to be, what, 25-ish, and he's obviously meant to be 15. So it's something a little off, but, you know, I think that Paul Thomas Anderson directs this very sensitively. Were you bought into it?
I totally bought into it, and it perfectly leads me on to the point about the sensitive direction and writing from a man. No one would have batted an eyelid if the genders were reversed, and we see films every day, especially back in the 70s, where you've got a 25-year-old man preying on a 15-year-old schoolgirl. But that wasn't the vibe I got from their relationship. What I loved most about this film, Alana Haim needs to quit music and act full-time, by the way, she's incredible, was the really sensitive depiction of the sexual harassment women face every second of their lives, especially back then, and no one thinks anything of it. So that was the tension I found, and it's super interesting. I wouldn't expect male viewers to necessarily pick up on it, because you wouldn't notice that kind of thing. But it's tiny microaggressions every single second of your life, and really sensitively directed and laced into the script. And Alana Haim is brilliant in that she just kind of, you see the sadness in her face, but it's no big deal, because it was no big deal. That was the brilliant tension I picked up on throughout, but the rest of it was gorgeous. It was as evocative as Almost Famous for me. I wanted to be there and live there. It's just a dream of a sun-drenched, brilliant nostalgia trip. I loved it.
Yeah, it had a Dazed, for me, it had a Dazed and Confused vibe as well, which is one of my most very famous films. Just purely in that kind of love letter to the 70s. I don't think Paul Thomas Anderson would not hold back. He would say, this is where he grew up. This is his love letter to it. Simon, it is packed full of cameos. I mean, packed. A little bit like Don't Look Up, but, you know, maybe slightly more successfully in this case. Did any of them stand out for you?
Sean Penn and Tom Waits together, their little section, although brief, not as much as you think from the trailer or anything, was absolutely great. Sean Penn as the older actor past it, still trying to pick up on his 20-year-old co-star. And Tom Waits, the lush in the bar, his old friend, going on about past glories while being completely foolish to anybody else who's looking at them. It's just absolutely superb. And but I think the best one is definitely Bradley Cooper. His turn again is absolutely wonderful.
Because this is based
John Peters.
Who did he really have it? Was he famed for having a short fuse?
From what I've heard, yeah. And also not quite all there as well, but he's one of the biggest names in Hollywood in the 1970s. Whenever they appear, it just gives it an extra spark, an extra cherry on top of this absolutely wonderful cake.
Okay, Henry, are you hoping then that Paul Thomas Anderson is going to maybe come back to... Because this is his first feature film in 5 years, nearly, which is quite, that is a long time since The Phantom Thread. Do you enjoy him when he's being funnier like this, or do you like his weightier vehicles, and are you hoping that he's going to be coming back sooner with something else?
I'm happy for him to keep experimenting. Between this and Phantom Thread, he made a short film for Netflix called Anima, which was a team-up with Tom York, in which it was kind of just this weird silent film kind of set to York's music, which I adored, and I think it's my favourite thing he's done. And so I'm happy for him to go wherever he wants to go next. I have complete faith that whatever he wants to do, whether it's a 70-minute horror film or a 4-hour biblical epic, I feel very confident that he's going to tackle it, and it's going to be incredibly entertaining, and it's only going to sit and grow. I'm going to love it more and more as time goes by.
And it will no doubt star Benedict Cumberbatch and Timothée Chalamet, I'd imagine, if we're going there. Following on last year, in 2019, obviously, we had Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from Tarantino. There is a sense that these sort of 50-year-old directors are now taking this nostalgic trip back down memory lane. Is there a danger of that becoming a little self-indulgent? That's to anybody who wants to answer it.
I would say there is a danger, because you could end up with a La La Land mess. But when something is as heartfelt as this, the director's tied to the story, has written it themselves, it comes through. But that's just the time period we're in. We've got a lot of these guys of a certain age who most likely come from North America. You're going to see a slew of these, but this is one of the good ones.
Also, and I think it was, and it was, to be fair, a golden age of Hollywood. We just lost Peter Bogdanovich, didn't we, with The Last Picture Show and that kind of thing. And this, the 70s was. And we're talking about Spielberg earlier on. And actually, that's because Spielberg has never fallen into that trap. Spielberg keeps going on and on and on, even though he was, at the absolute vanguard of 1970s filmmaking.
He has just remade the 1960s West Side Story.
Yes, but that's nothing to do with the 70s, isn't that? It's a late 50s period piece
of course,
from
Paul
61.
Thomas Anderson did start off as Boogie Nights, which is also set in LA during the late 70s, 80s. He has been that time period before.
I felt like this was like a slightly less raunchy. There was a definite Boogie Nights feel about it. It's like a less raunchy, sweeter teen Boogie Nights. Particularly as you have that whole kind of aspect of the entertainment, because Cooper Hoffman is playing this kind of child actor who's transitioning awkwardly into adult. Yeah. And one of my favourite scenes was actually Skylar Gismondo, who's going to be back soon in the Righteous Gemstones. I thought that was just perfectly done when Alana had come along as his chaperone. It is a really, really good film.
Skylar is my favourite actor of all time, currently.
Fave best friend, Skylar. Okay, so all over, all round, I think, and even those who didn't get a chance to talk about it on here also love this. Licorice Pizza is a thorough hit. It is a delight. It's a certificate 15, and it's showing at the Light and the Picture House. But we're going to move back to streaming for our penultimate film, and what you'd think is an idyllic beach holiday takes a sinister turn. I made that sound like horror.
Miss Caruso, welcome.
Thank you.
Excuse me, I work at the beach house. Just let me know if you need anything.
Great.
Get up! Mommy, get up!
You don't have kids?
Yes, I have two daughters.
Adapting Elena Ferrante's novel, The Lost Daughter, Maggie Gyllenhaal has brought her direct debut to the screen via Netflix with much critical fanfare. I think it debuted at the Venice Film Festival. And it had, like I say, it's had a lot of critic love, shall we say. Olivia Colman, again, actually is someone else who's fairly omnipresent at the moment, plays Lida, a professor of Italian literature whose quiet holiday takes an unexpected turn when the large Italian-American family staying at the same lakeside pensione lose their daughter one afternoon. This stirs up both memories for Lida and current complications that are occurring around her. Yossi, Maggie Gyllenhaal has corralled the most enormous amount of talent in this, both in front and behind the camera, because as well as Colman, we have Dakota Johnson, Jesse Buckley, Ed Harris, Peter Sarsgaard. I mean, that's not such a surprise. I suppose they are married. But do you think that in her debut as a director, she manages to successfully helm all of this and bring all of this together?
Yes and no. I'm a bit mixed on The Lost Daughter for multiple reasons. The first thing I will say is I think Maggie Gyllenhaal et al. Do a very decent job of looking at motherhood and sort of challenging conventional portrayals of motherhood and really looking at what's challenging. She's not the first to do it. There are other directors that have done it. But I think she does this fairly well in this film. However, it is a slow burn. This film, we're talking about length a lot, and I really think we need to talk about length in this film. It's over 2 hours long, and it felt longer. You have to have a lot of patience if you're going to watch this, especially when a lot of the characters are just not very likable. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of narcissism kind of in your face throughout the whole experience. And I think for some people it might be quite tiring. Having said that, I think, you know, I am a fan of Olivia Colman. I know not everyone in the studio is, but I am a fan of Olivia Colman. I think she does a really good job here. I think Dakota Johnson, you know, Ed Harris, you know, the whole cast, and Jesse Buckley, actually, I'll give a shout out to Jesse Buckley. I love Jesse Buckley. They do a really good job with what they've got. So going back to your original question in terms of the talent is very much there. It's just be patient.
Okay, you mentioned Jesse Buckley, who actually is playing the younger version of Olivia Colman. Ash, this is then a split time frame narrative. I'm not really giving much away with that. Were you more involved with one part of the story than the other part of the story?
Perhaps yes, because one part of the story was acted by professional actress Jesse Buckley, and the other part was the female Hugh Grant, who does the same thing in every film, Olivia Colman, who's endlessly boring. It's just the same kind of toothy, wide-eyed, what am I doing? What? So dull. I didn't care about her or whatever happened to her poor kids. Jesse Buckley, however, I felt the day-to-day struggle and bits of love shining through her exhaustion, even though you only see her for 30 seconds every now and again. I really did like that bit of the story. And I think they went too far the other way. So the big family that kind of crashes Olivia Colman's holiday. I just hated them so much. I didn't even want to watch them. It's the stress levels were Real Housewives finale. I can't watch those TV shows. They're not enjoyable for me. And this wasn't enjoyable for me. It was at once stressful and boring, which is quite a feat.
Well, you're obviously not meant to like them. We haven't mentioned, but Paul Mescal, obviously the breakthrough star of Ordinary People. Mm-hmm. plays sort of Will, who's helping there, and he does quite clearly say to Olivia Colman, don't mess with them, these are not good people. And they are obviously not good people. They are obviously mob adjacent, if not entirely mob involved. So, and I'm going to also say, Ash, I think that's really unfair on Olivia Colman. I don't think she does what she always does in this. It was funny, though. She is, I thought it was a really nuanced performance, and I thought there was a vast amount of expression in her face. It is a quiet film. There's a lot that rests in the characters' faces and expressions, and I thought she did an excellent job with that. Simon, we're all women talking about a film directed by a woman, talking about, you know, women, but you, as a... they're talking about women.
The boy is here.
You are a man.
You are a man, no. So to have a male perspective on this, I think, would be really interesting.
Yeah.
How, taking aside, because as a mother, I must admit that I found the things it has to say about what you're expected to be as a mother and how you are expected to behave, perhaps, was really interesting. As a piece of art for you, how did it work?
Yeah, I mean, I am clearly not the target audience, and I felt I was not the target audience when I just found this an incredibly dull slog.
But I want to say you are the target audience, Simon, because you love film. That's exactly what I'm trying to say.
That's the thing. I love film. The best thing about film is that it gives you different perspectives. You can, how different people react to different situations and stuff. You can be very, very empathic through film. This just bored me. I didn't find it interesting. I didn't think it was worth the payoff at the end when you find out what everything was all about. I'm not sure when you're going through about the talented cast that are in here, such as Ed Harris and Peter Sarsgaard, why Dakota Johnson was included in that list.
I mean, she's just got,
I mean, she's from a famous family. I mean, that's why.
Mm-hmm. I think we're being a little unfair.
She was in Peanut Butter Falcon, and I thought she was charming in that, actually. Yeah. And I think she's becoming... I'm going to hold my hand up. I didn't see any of the Fifty Shades films because that is not my bag. But I think she's developing into a... I think she's developing into a solid screen presence, and I liked her in this. I thought she was quite unrecognisable.
Yeah, I really liked her in this. I thought she did. I mean, she doesn't have much to work with, to be honest.
She does it well. Nothing there. The only thing I can say about it, Olivia Colman, I thought was good, and I really emphasise with her absolutely disliking lots of loud people. There is one scene in here where they. She reacts to a cinema full of people talking and being rowdy and asking them to be quiet, which was just so on the nose. It was just agonising to watch. So I think, as Ashley said, it's both boring and agonising, which wasn't a great combination.
I would say as well, this is based... So Elena Ferrante, she wrote this book in 2006, and she obviously then became very famous for the My Brilliant Friend quartet of novels, which is based on the story of two girls growing up in 1950s Naples and really sort of hit a sweet spot, it seemed, with all book reviewers about 2 years ago. I haven't read the book. I'm presuming no one else in here has read the book.
A friend of mine was saying earlier that she thought the film was very, very representative of the book and really captured the author's style in writing. And I'd have to... go along with that, saying yes, that's probably is true, but
having read,
still not for me.
Having read the first two in the My Brilliant Friend quartet, I would agree that I do because Elena Ferrante's writing is also quite spare, and yeah, there's more almost said in the spaces between the writing than there is in the writing itself, and that film felt a bit like this. There was more said to me in the silences, but there was some really. I was surprised. I didn't think I was going to like it because this isn't normally the kind of thing I like because it is long and it is slow and not much happens and the payoff is not hugely dramatic. But there was a delight. There was a delightfully simmering sense of tension for me all the way through, which worked for me. I wasn't bored and agonised. I was just kind of more agonised. And as soon as Ed Harris popped up, I knew I'd love it. And there's just a brilliant bit. Olivia Colman is, as an older woman who is still attractive, but... she's looking at Dakota Johnson, this incredibly sort of brittle personification of outward female sexuality, and Olivia Colman is still trying to be sexual and relevant, and I think that's a really, really sensitively portrayed thing, particularly for women who are in their late 40s and early 50s, because the fear of becoming invisible is really quite a real one, and I think the Maggie Gyllenhaal does a great job in holding that. There you go. I gave more of a review than that than anyone else. So I would say The Lost Daughter, I'm with the critics on this. I think it's well worth a watch. It's streaming on Netflix and it is a Certificate 15. So we are finally here to wrap up the show, and we are going to travel back to Victorian England with the world's hardest actor, hardest working actor, for the true story of artist Louis Wain.
Are you an illustrator?
Yes.
You're very muddy.
I was attacked by a 1.5-ton bull.
Oh!
I am prepared to offer you a staff position.
You capture something of a cat, perhaps because you yourself are an outcast.
I do it to provide for the 5 hungry and precocious sisters that I live at home with.
And we've had a governess.
I think you're the first person to see the cats are ridiculous, frightened, and brave. Like us.
Miss Richardson has had an incredibly positive effect on this family. Were you painting something?
Is something funny, Miss Wayne?
Not at all.
So as we've said, the hardest working actor of the last 2 months, Benedict Cumberbatch, is back. Back, I tell you, as a titular hero of the electrical life of Louis Wain, telling the story of the 19th century artist who became most famous for painting anthropomorphic, almost anime style of cats with oversized eyes, whilst also allegedly suffering from schizophrenia. And I think I haven't seen this, but I believe this covers both aspects of this dual story. Henry, how does this sit alongside Cumberbatch's other performances which are still available to watch, i.e. The Power of the Dog and Doctor Strange? Does he inhabit this real-life character sensitively and well?
He does. I think there's a kind of sense that this film seems a bit like business as usual. You know, Cumberbatch is one of those actors who kind of fits right in a period setting. And I think that may be why this film is flying under the radar a little bit, because it does look like a Benedict Cumberbatch period drama. And that is what it looked like to me at first. But I had a friend who said, no, you should look closer at this. This is actually, you know, a much more interesting film than it seems. And so I gave it a chance and I was really interested by it. I don't think it's always completely successful for me, but I think it is doing something that not a lot of other films at the moment are. It's using sound and visuals in really weird ways to try and tell the story of a man who, yeah, did have struggles with his mental health. The score is fantastic. It's weird to start talking about a score, but I love the use of theremin in it. The theremin is not a particularly common instrument in film scores, but they go really hard on it, and it really works to kind of show Wayne's interior mental state. And that is what the film is all about. It's, you know, on the surface, it is about his relationship with his wife and his drawings with his cats, but it's then also about Wayne's struggles throughout his life as he has to kind of work out his place in the world and why he doesn't really fit in with everyone else.
It's interesting you say that, because I did obviously do a tiny bit of research, and I see that this is directed by a guy called Will Sharp, who, as far as I can tell, he did 2 lesser-known works, Black Pond and The Darkest Universe, but currently Landscapers is showing on BBC, on the BBC, which is this four-part series with David Thewlis and Olivia Colman, which has been kind of talked about, again, I know, I'm so sorry, feels like we're sponsored by them, which has been compared to sort of Dennis Potter in its sort of surreal use of visuals and in a, yours was this, as Henry, I'm kind of basically picking up what Henry said, that this isn't what it necessarily seems to be from the trailer or the...
Yes, I totally agree with what Henry said. It's very easy to get trapped into thinking that this is quite a kooky, kitsch film. And actually, what's underneath that is quite a sensitively done portrait of Louis Wain. And to the point where actually I watched the film and was quite interested in Louis Wain and went and read about it. There's more to him than just him drawing cats, which is what I expected to see. In fact, the first half of that, you have the cat part, and then the second half of it goes into actually quite a darker story around Louis Wain's family, their financial troubles, his own troubles, as you've mentioned, with mental health. And I think I personally thought it was quite well done. And I was quite endeared by Benedict Cumberbatch's performance in this. I know we talked a few shows ago about Power of the Dog, and we were all a bit mixed on his performance there. I actually quite liked him in Power of the Dog, but I think he's better in this. And I think the film has a lot more to offer than what you might think.
I find that Benedict Cumberbatch tends to be better when he's working with a British accent. I always find that when he sees me focusing on an American accent, it distracts him from the rest of his work. Simon, you came in talking about this. Did you feel, do you agree with the Aussie that this, obviously, from looking at the trailer, it looks quite light and fluffy, like a cat. There are some cute kittens. But then it obviously takes a turn for the darker. Does it hit the beats correctly, or does it sort of sit between, does it not quite know what it wants to be?
I agree with that it's been missold. I loved the first hour of it. It was nice and eccentric. Again, all the performances in this film are great, and it does look interesting. However, halfway through, it does take a turn for the darker, and it just gets darker and darker, more miserable as you go along. By the time I came out to the cinema, I was actually quite miserable having just watched this. It wasn't what I was hoping for when you think a nice fluffy film about cats and artists. I'm not sure if the second half was as strong as the first half. I think it more jumps from place to place without actually going into any details about what was wrong or you know, portraying his mental difficulties in a more sensitive way. I thought it's too scattergun in the second half, and so wasn't as convincing or following. It's just like, just seemed to be using shorthand, said, yes, he suffers from delusions and things, and here we show a few, and everything goes wrong, and the film ends. So...
OK, Henry, we've talked about Benedict Cumberbatch, but this is also Claire Foy playing his wife, Emily Richardson Wayne. Obviously, again, she is perhaps in danger of being pigeonholed sort of period in period pieces. How was she in this for you?
I think she's really good. She, you know, her most famous role at this point is probably still playing the Queen in The Crown. But I think here she gets to have a bit more fun. She's in it much more in that, in, as Simon says, the kind of lighter first half. And so she gets to kind of have some jokes. And even though, yeah, the film does kind of start to get sadder, it still... Mm-hmm. Doesn't let itself get weighed down too much, I think. It's still, I find it interesting what Simon said. I think I wasn't too miserable by the end. I think Sharp is a really kind of, he's a really sharp touch with the film, and I think he's kind of able to carefully navigate exploring a sad topic without making it relentlessly and unbearably sad.
Well, hopefully, I guess, with a cast as starry as this, because we haven't even met Andrea Riseborough, Toby Jones, Adil Akhtar, Taika Waititi even pops up in this. You would hope that maybe this is going to take him to bigger recognition, because I think he's a really interesting guy to watch. So that is The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne, which I think has had sort of, you know, I think people are saying, try it. It's not what you necessarily think it's going to be from watching the trailer. And it's available still to watch at the Picture House.